Hello and welcome to the program. My name is Luke Hunt and this is another podcast for the Beyond the Lekong series, which is broadcast by The Diplomat. And with me today is Sushi Das. Sushi is a very well-known Australian journalist. She's a lecturer at RMIT, spent many years with The Age and working on the fact-checking desk, which is a culture that is changing rapidly given the shift in administrations in the United States. That's what we're going to talk about. Sushi, welcome to the program.
Hi, Luke.
The whole fact-checking phenomena, it kind of, I was going to say came out of nowhere. That's not true. But it did kind of explode and became an important part of journalism, perhaps 10 or 15 years ago, maybe more. What was your role? And you were in there at the start, and it spans the world.
Fact-checking back in the 1990s really was an internal thing on newspapers where you would have a fact-checker or magazines where you would have in-house fact-checkers and they would fact-check a copy before it was published.
Mm-hmm.
Around the turn of the century, we started seeing fact-checking outfits that were looking at content post-publication. More really, the way that the whole thing started is with political fact checking. So, 2003, around there, was when you saw factcheck.org, PolitiFact in the US, where fact checking organizations started. And they were really looking at politicians and claims that politicians were making
mm-hmm.
and fact checking that. Once we had social media coming on the scene, so looking at, you know, once Facebook was around and Twitter and all the rest of it, we saw a lot of sharing of content, and a lot of the content that was being shared was also not entirely accurate. So we started seeing fact-checking organizations popping up around the world that were really focused on fact-checking content on social media. So what started off as political fact-checking has sort of diversified, if you like, into social media fact-checking. I've done both types of fact-checking when I started at RMIT University in 2017, first looking at political fact-checking, and then we set up another fact-checking unit, RMIT Fact Lab, which looked specifically at social media content and fact-checking that. And we have worked in partnership with Meta doing that kind of stuff.
Right, we'll get there in a minute. Regards to Meta. But one of the things I noticed, particularly with the advent of social media and the internet going back earlier before smartphones, was that I think in the good old days, a politician could go to his local audience, say whatever you like, no one cared. Or the audience would be impressed. I mean, if you're living in remote Australia, which is might have one or two bigots and you want to appeal to those bigots for their votes, you can say whatever you like. No one else picked up on it. But then with the internet, social media, everything gets reported everywhere. And so the kinds of things they would say in their hometown are not the sort of things you can say to a national audience. And I think that seriously shifted the dynamics in terms of what they can and can't do. And they got into a lot of trouble because of it.
Yeah, I think you're right. But another thing that social media allowed politicians was that when social media came around, politicians no longer needed to be mediated by the traditional media. So,
right.
So the legacy media, newspapers, public broadcasters, who once were the sort of gatekeepers the journalism, reporting what politicians said and all the rest of it. Suddenly, politicians didn't have to go via those people anymore. Politicians could go over their heads and talk directly to the public using social media.
Right.
And the legacy media had no part in this relationship, if you like. And I think that was the beginning of politicians being quite loose-lipped.
Yep.
About what they said on social media. And often it has got them into trouble.
I totally agree. You know, we would have three or four layers of editors who would screen the copy, make sure it's right. But there were also the public relations firms and their own media minders. And they'll pay big bucks so that they didn't get into trouble. But it's like, never mind,
Oh, look, I think, you know, we've seen politicians' media units just get bigger and bigger in terms of, you know, the amount of people they employ to do the spinning for them. Yeah, there's, yeah, that's just a whole area that's just not showing any decline.
It's not, but it's also not showing any clarity.
No.
The messaging that keeps coming out is, I mean, they keep trying to dumb it down and make it sound a damn sight simpler. The immediate thought that comes to mind, given that we're in Australia, was when Dutton all of a sudden announced we're all going to get a nuclear power plant, which simple on on message, and he was crucified in the election. Because one of the reasons why I think he lost. But the point is that I find it all very jarring because it doesn't make sense to me, when you compare it with the way things were done, it's a little bit.
Yeah, there's no shortage of politicians saying crazy things throughout time, but I think that social media has just allowed them to be a little bit more casual,
right,
and a little bit more loose-lipped, and speaking directly to the public and using a language that the public feels comfortable with. And you can see that in posts by politicians, like, for example, Donald Trump.
Mm-hmm.
You can see that in politicians here, people like Barnaby Joyce,
right,
talk in a way that allow them to appeal to the ordinary person.
We're seeing it now in Southeast Asia with Hun Sen, the Shin and White Truths, and the Thai military, what's coming out of Myanmar. And I'm not too sure if they actually know who their audience is. So see, I think often they seem to be speaking what they think is important, what they think should be said, and the way you should take it, especially with a dictator. Goes, you know, you must listen to me. And it's like, no, it is. It's just getting lost.
Yeah, yeah.
But
that's interesting. I mean, look, I think politicians, that it was ever thus. They're constantly trying to control the narrative.
Yeah.
Okay. That's what it's all about for them, whether people buy into that narrative or not really sometimes depends on how clearly you talk to them and whether you're using their language, you know.
Sure. Now, again, the fact checking desk you ran with RMIT, correct me if I'm wrong, and that was in tandem with Meta, Zuckerberg, Facebook. How did that come about? And I remember you telling me earlier, I think there was like 91 or 93 similar labs around the world that were now no more or in the process of being discarded. But again, it's another sudden shift. But can you walk us through that? I think it's important.
So in a nutshell, what happened was, I think 2016 was a crucial year.
Mm.
So in 2016, some very important things happened. Firstly, we had the Brexit referendum in the UK, and we also had, in the lead up to Donald Trump being elected for the first time, we saw a lot of misinformation and disinformation circulating around that time. Facebook was the place where a lot of this false information was circulating. Facebook came under a lot of pressure for allowing this to happen. And we know also Myanmar and how a lot of misinformation has spread there as a result of, posts on Facebook. Facebook, after feeling this pressure, decided that it had to do something. So what it did was it decided to contract out fact-checking, if you like, and it contracted out fact-checking to fact-checking organizations around the world who, and they only chose fact-checking organizations that had been, that were signatories to the International Fact-Checking Network based in the US and their code of principles. So in other words, high-quality fact-checkers.
Right.
So these high-quality fact-checkers were then taken on board by Facebook. It was a commercial relationship. Facebook said, look, we'll help you find some mis and disinformation on our platforms if you will do the fact-checking. And then if you do fact-checking, what we'll do is we will downrank the posts that are spreading this kind of mis and disinformation, and we will grey out the posts, and we will penalise people who repeatedly try to monetize from this mis and disinformation. Once Facebook started having relationships with fact checkers around the world to do this kind of work, which we call third-party fact-checking. Fact-checking kind of lifted off, if you like, okay? I think around 2024, we were looking at about more than 90 fact-checking organizations around the world that were partnering with Facebook to do third-party fact-checking. But at the beginning of 2025, when Donald Trump came in for the second time,
mm-hmm.
the big tech companies decided they were going to be more, do the thing that was politically right for them, if I can put it that way. So what they did was they aligned themselves with Trump. And Trump, of course, is no friend of fact checkers. In alignment with Trump, decided that they Facebook was going to end its relationship with fact checkers in America. And that was the announcement that Zuckerberg made in January, where he said, that's it. Fact checkers are biased. They're involved in censorship. And we don't want to work with fact checkers anymore in America. Now, fact checkers around the world interpreted this as a signal that this is what Facebook would roll out around the rest of the world, probably by the end of 2025 or 2026. So while Facebook's decision really only applied to America, it did have a chilling effect on fact-checking organizations around the world. Simultaneously, we've seen fact-checking organizations around the world come under a lot of pressure, particularly from right-wing organizations. Right-wing media in Australia, for example, Sky News, has certainly been quite vicious when it comes to attacking fact-checkers in Australia.
Yeah, I'll just quickly point out that Sky News in Australia is not like Sky News in Britain.
No.
It is much more akin to Fox News in America.
Yes, it uses similar tactics.
Story parallels, yeah.
Yeah. High-profile commentators that are not shy to put forward their views. And you saw this with the voice referendum in Australia, Sky News, instead of operating like a news outfit, being neutral, presenting both sides, they would argue that they were presenting both sides. However, their commentators had an outsized influence on, and Sky News took a position on the voice referendum where they actively campaigned for the no side, okay, for the no campaign. So they weren't neutral in this at all. And even in their reporting, they were actively campaigning for the no side. So they didn't behave like what we expect normal news organizations
to behave.
Was it being pained? I think they were just, you know.
They were well out of order. I mean, it's just the usual nationalism, jump on the immigrant. The poor old white man is getting harassed and it's not his country anymore, which is kind of just, you know, it's just jarring. It's not true, but it seems to be the sort of mantra of these groups the world around. And then it's, where does it go next? Well, bang, straight back on the social media as Donald Trump comes into power.
Yeah.
And they're all emboldened again.
Yeah, yeah. Look, I think what's really interesting, particularly in Asia, is that when Facebook was partnering with fact checking organizations around the world, there was this massive boom in fact checking organizations, and that boom was led by Asia.
Right.
Asia has just if you go to India, there are huge numbers of fact-checking organizations. There's a fact-checking organization in Iran, except it's not run out of Iran, it's run out of Canada for so obvious reasons. We've got fact-checking organizations in Myanmar. So places where fact-checkers really come under a lot of pressure, Asia is the place where fact-checking has been booming. What will happen to fact-checking now that we have a strong indication that Facebook will pull out of these partnerships? It is likely that they will either look for alternative sources of funding or they will close. Certainly in the case of Australia, fact-checking, all fact-checking operations at RMIT University have now closed. There is only one fact-checking organization, which is Australian-based and a signatory to the IFCM Code of Principles, and that is AAP Fact Check.
Right.
The only fact-checking organization that's Australia-based. There is Agence France-Presse. They have fact-checking organizations, but they're not based in Australia.
Yeah, they've got one in Hong Kong.
Yeah, they're worldwide.
I did a podcast with Liam Timberlake not long ago, and he was actually telling me how the most fun and the kind of the greatest investigative work he had done in his 40-year career was on a fact-checking desk. And he did say he was quite chuffed because sometimes they'd correct people or they'd correct this post and they'd get a thank you note. It wasn't from the politician, but it was some person who put something out that wasn't quite right. I'm sorry, you know, I'm sorry. What do I do to fix this? And he said, you wouldn't quite expect that, but there's a lot of different types out there.
Well, I think when it's individuals who have inadvertently posted something
right.
which wasn't right, they're often, in my experience, very willing to either take the post down or change the wording or whatever it might be. When it comes to organizations where they, you know, skin in the game, it might be part of a political campaign or whatever, they're not so willing to change what they're saying. They know exactly what they're doing. They know who they're talking to. And it's a form of propaganda when you're putting inaccurate information out there and spinning it in a certain way. I mean, look, false information, gossip, rumors, it's been around since the beginning of, so yeah. The only difference now is that we have technology that can spread this kind of thing really, really fast in minutes around the world.
Yep.
We've not seen that before. And that can do an enormous amount of damage, particularly if that false information can have harmful effects on your health. So we only have to look at COVID and vaccine resistance to know how that happened. Or if it has negative impacts on your financial life, so did it sucked in by a scam. But more importantly, when you have false information that undermines the democratic process, then we're looking at something much bigger here, okay? And there's lots of that kind of stuff going around. So when you have social media posts that say, such and such an election was not properly conducted, that an election was stolen, as we saw Trump arguing.
Yep.
That kind of thing where it undermines democracy, that is a very difficult problem to deal with. And I think that when you start seeing coordinated, inauthentic behavior, which is what Facebook calls it, and so this is nefarious state actors pumping out false information for whatever reason. So we're talking about China, Russia, Iran. These countries are known to have these campaigns where they want to cause disruption. Now, these disinformation campaigns are not necessarily trying to change the way you vote. Sometimes it's just about creating uncertainty, chaos, and confusion, which of course leaves people wondering what's got more to do and fearful. And when people are fearful, they're so much easier to control.
And you've got to wonder how far it can go. I did another podcast with Chloe Riddell, who's a French member for the EU Parliament, and she was charged with writing a report on transnational repression. So you have the Iranians, the Vietnamese in Germany, a lot of Ukrainians living in the EU who are being exposed to the Russian oppression coming through. And so with transnational repression, the attacks are often through online and through the media. And one thing I did ask though is, are these attacks, which are pretty much verbal, threatening, people are out to disgrace someone else, make them look bad, undermine what they're saying online, that along those sorts of lines. But, you know, is transnational repression linked to transnational crime? And you know, she was good. She said, yes. And the reason why is because the people who are taking advantage of these kinds of, I was going to say anomalies, that's not the right word, but the brave new world we live in, they know who the nasty actors are in these countries.
Mm.
If you're going and trying to press someone online through social media and you physically going to attack them, or worse, a lot of bashings, assassinations, and all kidnappings and all sorts of nasty things going on in these countries, coming out of countries like Russia and Iran. And she kind of beautifully tied the whole lot together. And to my mind, it just starts with a lie.
Well, see, the thing with a lie, let's talk about the word lie.
Yeah.
Lie, for example, is not a verdict we ever put on a fact check.
Right.
All right. And I'll tell you why. Because when you say someone is lying, you are sort of saying, I know what was going on in their head. They deliberately did what they did. Now, as fact checkers, we can never get inside someone's head, but what we can only ever say is this information is correct or is not correct. We can't put a motive behind it, if you like, okay? Which is why we never use lie as a sort of verdict. And I know Washington Post has used the Pinocchios and the number of Pinocchios that.
Okay.
So there is a sort of, they're sort of leaning towards lie there, but they're not actually using the word lie. But we, certainly at RMIT, when we were doing our fact check, we never used the verdict lie because that suggests that we know that they deliberately. Because we don't know that for sure.
Look, it's required to be intentional.
Yeah, it's intentional.
Okay.
You knew what you were doing.
Yeah.
And we can't always, certainly with the politicians, they spin a lot. And, let me tell you something. We've had a political progress tracker running for a number of years, okay? When you look at the false information that politicians put out there, you would think that most of the time they were lying. If you went to the public and said, do your politicians lie a lot? They would say, yeah, I think they do. I think that's the sort of received wisdom generally, okay?
Well, people know. Not everybody's stupid.
But the truth is, during our fact-checking, when we looked at claims that politicians made, what we found was that most of the time they weren't actually outright saying something inaccurate. What they often did was just, there was a grain of truth in what they were saying, but they would spin it in such a way that they would either cherry pick data or present an argument out of its proper context. And so you didn't often say something they said was incorrect. You're more likely to say, look, it's mostly there, but not quite, or it's out of context. That's the kind of verdict we often put. And when we look at the analysis that came out of the promise tracker that we ran, what we found was that most of the time, politicians were not lying, or rather not putting out inaccurate information. They were just putting out vague, not contextualized information, or spinning it.
Right.
So what the research, repeated in many countries around the world, most of the time, politicians, when it comes to promises that they make, they do keep their promises. So if you look at the Abbott government, when it came in 2013, we were running a promise tracker then. I think if I remember correctly, it was about 70% of promises that Abbott made were actually carried out.
Tony Abbott.
Yeah, Tony Abbott, that's right. Most of the time, politicians do carry out their promises. So the view that we have of politicians, anecdotally in the general public, is actually quite different to what the research shows, especially when it comes to politicians outright lying or not delivering on electoral promises. The research shows that most of the time they do deliver on their promises, and also they don't often outright tell untruths. They just spin it. In a way.
Is it like a barroom conversation in that, you've got to be careful who your audience is, and it might be safer to keep it vague, that way they can't pin you down.
Oh, they're very good at that.
Right.
They're very good at that, which is, of course, a fact checker's nightmare.
Yeah. Yeah. So where do you think fact checking is going? I mean, what I meant before when I was referring to, I'm not saying that I don't think fact-checking is going to die. I think it will survive and thrive in its own way. But when you look at around the world, fact-checking does impact on everybody in the world. It goes beyond Australia, beyond the Mekong, it goes. The people who are misusing the system, we always seem to be tracking them back to the same old countries, totalitarian dictatorships. They have nasty histories of going after their own in foreign lands in Europe and in Australia. In fact, Australia is a heap in terms of legislation guarding against transnational repression. But I think what I'm driving at is that it all seems to be part of the same equation. And if we're going to just disregard fact checking as Meta has done, it's not a good sign. But is Meta that important?
It has been important because it's the largest funder of fact checking organizations around the world by a country mile.
Okay.
No one was putting as much money into fact checking as Meta was. Okay, and still is at the moment. I think the future of fact-checking, I think there are two things that fact-checking is up against. One, it's really difficult to get funding to do the kinds of work. Fact-checking just isn't sexy, okay? So no one wants to fund fact-checking. That's the first thing. Secondly, we are under attack from right-wing critics who think fact-checking is done by lefty radicals who are all biased and they're in the business of censorship, trying to drag us into a culture wars.
Right.
Those are the two main things that fact-checking is up against. And if I could add another third thing, I'd say AI.
Right.
AI is generating all sorts of content, which is now becoming very, very difficult for people to distinguish between what is fact and what is fiction.
We're calling it AI slop.
Oh.
And I think it's going to burn the house down, to be honest, because there's just so much of it out there. It's just smashing everything. I know, for example, in Southeast Asia, that, say, with the conflict between Cambodia and Thailand, you could throw in Myanmar as well with the conflict there. There are many people generating stuff which is pro this and pro that, but it's crap and it's wrong, and it's obviously wrong to the point where the governments, that these people who are generating this AI stuff, it's not wanted.
Yeah.
You're getting in the way.
Yeah.
Well-meaning and all that, and bold propaganda and everything else, but it's burning down its own house. There's just so much rubbish out there.
Yeah, I think and shitification is the term use
I like that
article. I can't remember the author's name right now, but you asked me what is the future of fact checking. Well, I think that, you know, I've told you who the enemies of fact checking are. I think the future is really going to be about trying to get some more funding, if you can, but that's not going to be easy. But I think this is not the problem of mis and disinformation spreading on social media, going viral real quickly. This is not a problem that only fact checkers can solve.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. So we cannot just turn to fact checkers and say, you sort this out, because they can't. There's too much of it. This is a whole of society problem. It is going to take fact checkers, a better kind of civics kind of understanding in countries where people understand what their system is all about. You've got to understand how laws are made in your country, how your parliament works, all of this kind of stuff. People just got to be better informed. And so what we've seen in the world of fact-checking is this branching out into media literacy, where people are being taught how to spot false information. What does it look like? What do you do when you... That whole...
The grammar on AI is an easy one, if you know your grammar.
That's, you know, your grammar. So it's all about media literacy now. I personally don't like calling it media literacy because...
Well, you can read.
We're not really trying to become literate about the media or the vehicle through which we get this information. It's news literacy or information literacy is what we're really talking about. We're trying to get people to do things that they might not be used to. So, you know, at the end of the evening, when you've maybe had a glass of wine and you're sitting in bed surfing through Instagram or Facebook or whatever it might be, it's really easy to see something that sort of outrages you, gets the your blood heated up, which is what, of course, the creators of disinformation want. They want you to get outraged. And of course, when you're outraged, you take it, you share or you like. And so what we as fact checkers want is for people to slow down. When you're surfing social media, slow down and keep asking yourself three things. One, what is the source of this information? Secondly, what is the evidence to support the claim being made in that particular post? And thirdly, what are other people saying about this? Which is essentially means open a new tab on your computer, put in a few keywords. But those three things, what is the source of the information, what is the evidence, and what are other people saying? Those are three basic tenets of starting to fact check by yourself, okay? Everyone can do it. It just takes a little bit of time, not that much time, but it's absolutely doable. And so I think in terms of the future of fact checking, I think the people are going to have to understand that fact checking is something they have to do themselves. They have to take the responsibility to educate themselves to know that there is a lot of AI slop, there is a lot of disinformation, and there is a lot of false information being put out there by nefarious state actors. So we have to protect ourselves by being more engaged with how to do a little bit of fact checking ourselves.
And on that note, sound advice. I couldn't agree with you more. Sushi Dads, thank you very much. It's been a lovely chat.
Thank you, Luke.
It was good.